Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Behind every bill that comes out of Congress, there is behind closed doors negotiation. That's politics, and always has been. But an expose this week from the Boston Globe on just how much untrammeled power a small number of committee members and big money lobbyists are wielding today might shock even the most seasoned Congress watcher. Tonight on Point, allegations of the death of debate, due process, and public oversight in the U.S. Congress 2004. But first, we go to Washington, where the 108th Congress is in the end of its session, the end of session scramble tonight. Among legislation still being crafted is a controversial corporate tax bill, waiting for a vote, I guess, to be completed there. Joining me now from Washington is Gail Shattuck, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Scramble's a good word for it.
Is it still underway, this big, big tax bill with all kinds of goodies stuffed in it, or has the vote
Absolutely.
Been completed?
No, that the House is finishing their roll call vote right now. Where it's expected to pass. The interesting battle is going to be in the Senate, where you have senators on both sides of the aisle who are saying that they will filibuster, block any bill that doesn't include FDA regulation of tobacco. This tax bill has a $10 billion bailout buyout for tobacco, and senators want it balanced by giving the FDA some authority to regulate the industry.
Gail, you and I talked about this particular issue before. I thought that was fundamental to the bailout of this industry.
It absolutely was fundamental on the Senate side. However, it was taken out of the conference committee. It's been very interesting. I was struck by seeing Erskine Bowles, who is a candidate, Democratic candidate for Senate in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Who spent Wednesday lobbying Democrats in the Senate on this bill. He thinks that if the buyout goes through and he's seen as having a role in it, it could be enough to turn that election in his favor on November 2nd.
But no one
has ever seen anything like this, Tom, a candidate acting like a U.S. senator already.
Even though he's not even in Congress. Gail, step back to this overall tax bill. There's $140 billion in tax breaks in this bill, but as I understand that, none of it is really headed toward individuals. It's all about businesses, multinational companies, bow and arrow makers, fishermen, narrow interests.
Well, some of it is for individuals. For example, there's an income tax deduction for state sales taxes, for states without income taxes.
Okay.
So Texas, New Hampshire, the last time I was there, had no income
You got that
tax.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there will be some benefit for individuals. But by and large, you're right. This is a corporate package. It includes breaks for shipping, timber, fishing, ethanol, very important piece for senators like Tom Daschle in a tight race in South Dakota. Breaks for Hollywood movies, although about $1 billion less than they had under previous law. For the Alaskan natural gas pipeline, so there's little pieces for a lot of corporate interests.
And what's the rationale for this, Gail? Is this supposed to be economic stimulus, or is this just a Christmas tree giveaway?
Well, it started as a fix on a $50 billion U.S. export tax subsidy, which the World Trade Organization said was illegal. And tariffs on more than 1,000 U.S. products have been going up steadily ever since their decision. It's up to 12% now as of October 1st. So this was a fix that had to be made. But in making it, they've added about $140 billion in new tax cuts, although it's offset. It was announced today, down to about $1 billion by additional closing of loopholes. For example, Hollywood losing $1 billion in tax cuts. That balances what the ethanol producers might be getting.
So they're saying they're giving with the one hand and taking away or tightening with the other.
But for business, Tom, this was the last train out of the station and a very important one.
And piling on it big time, John McCain on the Senate side complaining bitterly today about removing this FDA oversight, saying what the conferees have done is remove the linchpin in the passage of this legislation.
That's right.
It's a complete sellout to the tobacco companies.
That's right.
Gil, overall, what is the legacy of this 108th Congress?
Well, I think it's a very mixed legacy. It's a Congress that came in saying for the first time in decades we have a Republican in the White House, a Republican-controlled Senate, and a Republican-controlled House. What great things we will do. And it hasn't turned out that way. You know, what actually has been produced in terms of spending bills, most of which are still not done. The 9/11 reorganization might get done, but if it does, it's a very last-minute rushed process without the kind of deliberation that the legislative branch used to provide. And I think that is the issue being raised in the series you're discussing tonight, and it's a very important one. What has happened to the deliberative function of Congress, and is it really a check and balance for the executive?
Gil, we'll hear much more on that tonight, but what's your front row perspective, covering Congress as you do, on that very question?
I'll tell you, I'm very interested in what's happening with the ethics issues swirling around House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, because these, not just what the Ethics Committee has already done, there have been three very unusual reprimands in a week.
Rapid fire, one after another here.
Right, rapid fire, pointing to a whole pattern of behavior which appears to be trading access for money. And I think if the Congress really grapples with this issue, they're going to be forced to deal with some of the other questions, too, about closed-door meetings and no deliberation and debate and, you know, the sort of decline of the legislative function.
Looks like a big can of worms may be opened soon. We're going to open a bit of it tonight. Gail, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Gail Chadwick is congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. Backroom dealing is a way of life in Congress. The majority party controls the procedural levers, allowing that party to move its legislative agenda ahead. But a just-completed investigative series by the Boston Globe says the Republican-controlled House has taken that to a new level, stifling debate, ignoring rules, embracing secrecy, and empowering lobbyists over many legislators. Talking about just that tonight, and you can join the conversation. Backroom dealing is nothing new on Capitol Hill, but do we have something new going on here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to be hearing a lot tonight about the Rules Committee in the House of Representatives, and we'll talk later in this hour with the Republican chair of that committee, David Dreyer. But first, joining me now are the co-authors of the Boston Globe series, Susan Milligan, staff writer for the Boston Globe, joining us from Washington. Hi, Susan. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And joining me in the studio tonight in Boston, Chris Rowland, also a staff writer for the Globe and right there on this series as well. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
So you guys have laid out a lot of real estate in the newspaper to opening up a picture that many of us had not fully taken on board about what's going on in Congress these days. And Chris Rowland, you open it with a story about this little matter of Accenture. I wish you'd just tell us that story as a kind of case in point of the kind of thing that happens in Congress these days.
Well, thanks, Tom. Actually, I might have to defer to Susan on that one.
Great. Susan, please give it to us. You guys have to set me straight on who's got what here.
Well, this was a really interesting example because Accenture is a company that is based in Bermuda, and therefore they legally avoid paying U.S. taxes. And they had been given a $10 billion Homeland Security contract. I think it was for something called Visit USA or something, the technology for, you know, when people are coming into the country for security reasons.
And this didn't just come out of nowhere. Accenture used to be Anderson Consulting, right? I mean, this was an American company, part of this sort of trend to drifting offshore to avoid U.S. taxes.
Yes, although they point out that when they did incorporate, they did just they were never Accenture itself was never incorporated.
Well, but
the
it's
United
kind of splitting hairs, isn't it? I mean,
well,
they changed
all right,
their
but
name
I'm,
and
in,
they.
In fairness, I'm just being fair
okay,
to them.
Okay.
So anyway, they got this $10 billion Homeland Security contract, and you know, some people were pretty upset that they were getting a not only a government contract, but of all things, a Homeland Security contract when they weren't located, you know, even in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So the Appropriations Committee voted rather overwhelmingly in a bipartisan manner to deny them this contract, to take it away, and also to prevent companies in the future from getting Homeland Security contracts if they were located overseas. And then it went to the Rules Committee. Now, a lot of people don't know what the Rules Committee is. I mean, it's maybe they just think that they decide, you know, I don't know how you talk to each other on the floor. And actually, there are rules about that. But anyway, Congress, of course, is the House is made up of 435 people, and it can be sort of unwieldy. And everyone acknowledges that there is a need to have rules about how long you debate something, what kind of amendments you can have, that sort of thing. So the Rules Committee takes legislation when it comes from a legislative committee, and they kind of clean it up, and they get the right language in there, and they may rule that some amendments are not in order for whatever reason, and they limit them. Well, the Rules Committee just decided that this amendment that would deny this contract to Accenture was simply not in order, and that it would take this you know, extreme manipulation or interpretation of House rules to let it on, which you could maybe buy except that they decided that the other part of the amendment that would deny future contracts was in fact in order. So that never even got to the floor, where I think there's a strong possibility it would have passed because there's a lot of anger in the House about companies that are avoiding taxes, and they're hearing about it from their constituents.
So people didn't want to give a $10 billion American contract to a company that wouldn't even keep its headquarters in the United States.
Right.
Accenture stepped up, you report, with $2 million in lobbying,
right.
And a vote is overturned in the Rules Committee pretty far from the light of day of a floor debate.
Right. So they never even got to vote on it on the floor. It's not as though they put it on the floor and even twisted arms and got their way. People didn't even have the opportunity to vote on it on the floor. And this happens all the time. I mean, I think a lot of people think that, you know, why isn't my congressman, you know, introducing this or, you know, introducing an amendment to do this or changing this piece of legislation to do this? They have very few opportunities, actually, to change legislation once it's on the floor. And then your only option is to vote against the entire package, which, you know, you don't always want to do because what are you going to vote against an entire defense appropriations bill because you don't like, you know, small pieces of it and so forth. So it really gives lawmakers a limited opportunity to have a role in shaping legislation. And it's not just Democrats who are upset about this. Republicans are very upset, too. The committee chairmen feel that their authority is being usurped by the Rules Committee. They spend a lot of time working on legislation in a legislative committee. Many of the committees, well, some of the committees are more bipartisan than others. Appropriations has always had a reputation for being more bipartisan than some of the other committees. But
Through all of this, you write that the lobbyists are with their hands all over the steering wheel here. $799 million spent on lobbying for just two bills on Medicare and energy.
Well, yeah, it was more than $700 million on the two put together. I mean, there was some overlap there in the $799 figure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the other thing about the lobbyists, I mean, look, lobbying is part of free speech, right? I mean, this is an opportunity for people in an organized way to, to tell Congress how they feel about something.
But you paint a picture of congressmen themselves not getting a chance to speak and lobbyists speaking loud straight into the ear of power.
Well, some lobbyists. That's the other thing. I mean, I spoke to Lois Gibbs, who I'm old enough to remember as an upstate New Yorker, was the housewife, as we called them then, who exposed the whole Love Canal, toxic waste situation in Niagara Falls. And, she's been lobbying on environmental issues for a long time, and she says she just can't get in to see anybody anymore.
She's not on the GOP agenda.
They have no interest. And she said she did not have this problem in, you know, earlier years.
Chris Rowland, let me ask you here in Boston. Democrats wielded a big stick as well. Tip O'Neill was famously powerful in Congress when Dems had the majority. Is it so different now?
Well, I think it may be to a certain extent. I mean, you know, in the old days you had the Democrats certainly ram things through. But I think that's because of the increased partisanship in Congress and sort of some of the animosity that is built up. I think that you have sort of a less collegial debate. And it does seem to me that the Republicans are wielding their power in a much more concerted way.
I have to say, reading your series, less collegial sounds like the very mildest way of summing this up. It's quite an astonishing picture. We'll come back and look at some of the details. We are talking tonight about how the GOP-dominated Congress does business in 2004. Allegations of the death of debate, of due process, of public oversight, and the triumph of lobbyist influence. My guests tonight, Boston Globe reporters Susan Milligan and Christopher Rowland. You can join the conversation as well. Backroom dealing is nothing new on Capitol Hill. But do we have something new going on here? Have you noticed less open debate coming out of the House of Representatives? Are you getting the picture? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the GOP-dominated Congress in Washington and how it is doing business in the year 2004. I'm with Boston Globe reporters Susan Milligan and Christopher Rowland. Their series lays out some big charges here. There's sort of the death of debate, of due process, of public oversight, the triumph of lobbyist influence. Ruling parties have always wielded that power with gusto, but this time they're saying is something different. We're going to hear from one of the primary targets of their critique in a few minutes, David Dreyer, chairman of the House Rules Committee. But before we do, I want to invite you into this conversation. What do you think? Is a ruling party with a narrow majority entitled to do whatever it takes to push its agenda through? Were the Democrats any better when they ran Capitol Hill? Is this just minority party sour grapes, or do we have a problem here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan Milligan, I wish you would take us right down through the bullet points, the main findings from all the work you've done on this. If you could just lay those out for us quickly, one by one.
Okay, well, I don't have it in front of me. I'll try to remember. But the first thing is that there's less debate on bills on the floor, and you can use an example of something as important as the Iraq resolution, the war resolution. They spent less than 2 days debating No Child Left Behind, which is ushers in an historic involvement of the federal government in primary education. That was just a few days on the floor. You take something like defense authorization, which is sounds like a boring bill, and it kind of is, but it's important. It lays out defense policies for the country. They used to spend 2 or 3 weeks on defense authorization discussing it on the floor. They spent 2 days on it this year. So there's a lot less debate.
And that happens because of the way the gavel is wielded?
Yes. And that brings me to my second point, okay, which is Congress doesn't meet that often anymore. Typically, except in a week like this last week, like, you know, they're like college students. They sort of, you know, do nothing all year and then work for 3 weeks all night. So they're trying to finish up. But, you know, they typically come in on a Tuesday at 6 o'clock, have a half an hour of votes on something that are called votes under suspension, meaning bills under suspension of the rules. These are bills like renaming post offices or honoring a Boy Scout troop or something
like that.
They're not terribly consequential. They actually changed the rules last year to allow votes on those sorts of bills also on Wednesdays in the middle of the week, which means it leaves less time for substantive debate on important bills.
So real debate gets pushed aside. You also talk about something, this Dracula Congress charge,
right,
the middle of
right.
the night meetings. What's that about?
Well, that's when, you know, the Rules Committee on significant bills, I mean, not on a bill under suspension, but on significant bills has to sort of clean up the language of a bill and, you know, make some amendments in order, out of order, and determine how much time will be allowed on debate. They might say, you know, an hour for each side and plus a half an hour for this amendment, a half an hour for this amendment. And more and more often they're meeting, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night. In fact, I think it was 54% of the Rules Committee meetings were something called emergency session. They're supposed to give 48 hours notice before they have a Rules Committee meeting, so people don't always know about it. And then they're writing in the middle of the night, and then the people who come in and vote in the morning, they don't know what's in the bill. I mean, everyone...
They don't know what's in the bill before they have to vote on it.
They often don't know what's in the bill, and they'll make changes. I mean, even if something has sort of been out there, they'll make changes in the Rules Committee that they don't know about. For example, when they voted on the Patients' Bill of Rights, which granted never became law, but the deal that they had worked out with the House and the Senate, with the negotiators, was that you could sue your HMO if their failure to cover you was a proximate cause of your injury or your death. Well, they changed one word. They changed a proximate cause to the proximate cause. And we're talking about a really big bill. And that's virtually an unprovable standard. I mean, an HMO could say, well, our failure to cover you wasn't the approximate cause of your death. Your car accident was. So they'll do things like that. Another example is the Patriot Act, the USA Patriot Act, where there really was a lot of bipartisan work on that. People like Barney Frank, very liberal member of Congress, working with Jim Sensenbrenner, chairman of the committee, pretty conservative member of Congress. They worked on a bill together. They passed it, I think it was 36-0 out of the committee. And the administration didn't like it because in their minds it was a weaker bill than the Senate had produced, and the Democrats were in charge of the Senate at the time, and the attitude of the administration was, well, why should we take a weaker bill from the House? We run the House. So the Rules Committee also changed that in the middle of the night, and they put in the sneak and peek provision, and they took out one of the sunsets.
So really stretching the definition of what that committee does to an incredible degree, as you describe it, favoring secrecy and speed, your words, over debate and negotiation, ignoring longstanding rules and practices, meeting in secret, meeting in the middle of the night. Of course, it is the House Rules Committee that you're really pointing at here, and I want to turn to a piece of tape now. I talked not long ago with Congressman David Dreyer of California's 26th District, and I put his your charges, Susan and Chris, to him. I asked him to respond to the charges in the Globe's report that his committee was clamping down on debate.
Well, Tom, I'm going to put the Boston Globe in the undecided column in their assessment of me on this. I will tell you that, quite frankly, it's a mischaracterization of the work that we do in the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee was established on the second day of the first Congress, and our responsibility is to move our agenda and to do it in the fairest way possible. And I am a student of James Madison. When I was an undergraduate at the Claremont Colleges out in California, I spent a great deal of time focusing on the rights of the minority, and I served 14 years as a member of the minority before I came to this body. And so my party, having been in the minority for actually four uninterrupted decades, ended up winning the majority in 1994, and we made some changes that were unprecedented. We put into place a guaranteed right for the minority to have what we call a motion to recommit, basically a bite at the apple, a guaranteed opportunity to amend a piece of legislation. When we were in the minority, that was often denied us.
But let's talk about amendments.
Let me just tell you, this amendment, the fact that you guarantee a motion to recommit, that in and of itself is an opportunity to amend legislation.
1977, 1978, 85% of non-appropriations legislation in the House offered under open rules, open to amendment. Last year, the Democrats in power, 57% overall. Under you, 15%, we're reading here. That seems a very small portion.
Well, the fact of the matter is, at the time that the Democrats had that majority, they had, a 90 to 100 seat majority. We have a very narrow, it's one of the narrowest majorities in the history of the country. And for that reason, we have obviously had to, in moving this agenda, do so in what we believe to be the most balanced way.
Why so much business done in the middle of the night, Congressman
Dreyer? It's not done in the middle of the night.
The Dracula Congress is the phrase.
Just inaccurate. We don't meet in the middle of the night. I don't know why they use that term.
Patient's Bill of Rights legislation, 2001, Rules Committee made a one-word change in the middle of the night that limited the liability of HMOs that deny coverage to the patients.
I don't know what the middle of the night is. I will tell you, we have met in the last 2 days on important legislation, the Jobs Creation Bill and on this 9/11 Recommendations Act at 7 o'clock in the morning. That is not the middle of the night. We meet, and frankly, if you look at debates throughout history, the United States Congress, and when I was in the minority again, we would often, the Congress meets late at night, and especially in the waning days, often legislative bodies, whether a state legislature or the United States Congress, meets at night, but we try our darndest not to. In fact, there had been, you're correct, this trend of often meeting very late, and so what I try to do is to meet early in the morning.
This gets beyond you.
It's important for us to look at the final product.
Final product. Another point here. I just want to get through these that the Globe has raised and get your response. They say 3,407 pork barrel projects added to appropriations bills in this year's federal budget, never debated or voted on beforehand, not even clear who the congressional patron was. This compared to 47 such projects in 1994, last year of Democratic control. What's up with that?
I have no idea. From my perspective, if you look at appropriations bills, they're considered under an open amendment process. Members are allowed to strike every single one of those provisions on the House floor. They're described in this story as pork, and any member can stand up and strike provisions in appropriation spending bills.
How about
The Rules Committee did not deny the chance for members to do just that, and I think that if you look at the bipartisan nature of these so-called pork barrel projects. I suspect that they were agreed to.
Let's look at a specific instance. This the technology company Accenture put its headquarters in Bermuda. It was supposed to get a $10 billion home security contract. There was a vote to deny that. They ended up getting it after a ruling by your committee. Even though they're not paying American taxes, they're offshore, and there was a strong sentiment against that. $2 million lobbying by Accenture, a real full court press, doesn't look great.
Well, as I pointed out in the interview in the Globe, it's very clear that that amendment that came forward did not comply with the rules of the House, and it would have required a special waiver to make it in order. One of the things that we've done is, again, within the last 30 minutes, we have reported out the Jobs Creation Act, which is designed to encourage American job creation here by trying to reduce the tax and regulatory burden in the United States so that we're able to follow the models of Singapore and Ireland to make our economy more competitive so that we'll be able to compete globally.
Congressman Dreyer, you've said we have the majority, that is the GOP now. We won the election, and we have an obligation to move our agenda. Is there a point at which your fervor in moving that agenda blocks out the minimal decent amount of debate?
Well, Tom, what I said at the open of this interview is that moving our agenda in the fairest, most balanced way possible mm-hmm. is my priority, and I continue to do that. And frankly, you know, much of what we have done has, when it's gotten to the floor, been considered with strong bipartisan support. But again, remember that we have a very narrow majority, and we often will see people who would try to block what it is we're trying to do, which, frankly, the American people have supported. The American people have supported reducing the tax burden. The American people have supported our defense capability, which is winning. And so to try and infer from the action of the Rules Committee of this Congress that we've been anything other than successful is, I think, a gross mischaracterization of our work.
David Dreyer, we're glad to hear from you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Congressman David Dreyer of California, chairman of the House Rules Committee. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. Refutation on every side of the allegations, the findings of a Boston Globe series of articles about how the Congress works these days that we're talking about tonight. I want to bring in another congressional voice from Washington right now, James McGovern. He's congressman from the 3rd District of Massachusetts. He is one of four Democrats on the House Rules Committee. He's serving his fourth term in Congress. He knows a lot about this Rules Committee. He's a former member of the staff of the late Representative Joseph Moakley, who once headed the Rules Committee. Of course, that's when Democrats were in charge. James McGovern, thanks for joining us tonight.
Happy to be with you.
So you heard David Dreyer say there they have a thin majority, but they're determined to drive their agenda forward, and they're doing it, he said, in the fairest and most balanced way possible. You've clearly got a partisan stake in this, but what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, look, David Dreyer is a friend of mine, and he's got some interesting spin on the fact that the Republican leadership regularly closes down this process. My late grandfather used to say that he could talk a cat off a fish truck. I mean, but the fact of the matter is that this place has become more closed. As you mentioned, and the Boston Globe article mentioned, less open rules. They have ruled this place with an iron fist. They have denied amendments. They have met in the middle of the night. They have met not only at 7 in the morning, they've met at 5 in the morning, at 4 in the morning. They have a process that is not very democratic. And I understand that the Rules Committee's primary focus is to help move the process forward. And I agree with David Dreyer that it should be done in the fairest possible way. But that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is our democracy is being undermined. This is not what our founders envisioned. They thought of the House of Representatives as a truly deliberative body where people could debate issues, where people could offer amendments and offer different points of views. What happens here on a regular basis is that the debate is closed. Legislation is written, you know, behind closed doors, and oftentimes very important pieces of legislation don't get much debate at all. I mean, the Medicare prescription drug bill that I think is a disaster, but that bill was considered at 1 a.m. on June 27, 2003. There were close to 60 amendments submitted to the committee by Republicans and Democrats,
yeah.
And only one was made in order. The bill was reported out of committee at 5 a.m., and that's when we debated it. I mean, what kind of process is that?
Is it
an open process?
Congressman McGovern, let me ask you, is it really so different from when your old boss, Joe Moakley, was in charge?
I think it is. I'm not here to defend every action that the Democrats took when they were in the majority. I mean, you can go back and point to examples where I think they overused or maybe even abused some of their power. But I've never, ever seen it like this. As the Globe article points out, if you look at the statistics, there are more closed rules now than ever before. I remember when Joe Moakley was the chairman of the Rules Committee, they used to have bipartisan caucuses where before the committee would begin, he'd invite not only Democrats but Republicans into his office and say, okay, let's talk about the bill and what are your priorities. We don't do that here. And routinely, the Rules Committee kind of waives all points of order, which means that under normal circumstances, for example, we're debating a tax bill on the floor today.
Right.
We're supposed to have 3 days to look at the bill. All members of the House, the members of the Rules Committee, are supposed to be able to look at this thing for 3 days. They waive that, and today we're debating a tax bill that's several hundred pages long. Nobody's read it. We just got it a few hours ago, and we're going to vote on it, any minute. That's not the way you should legislate.
Does it make you feel kind of useless as a congressman?
No, because I've never felt a greater sense of purpose, because I believe in this institution. I worked here when Joe Moakley was the chairman of the Rules Committee. I worked when Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the House. I appreciate what the House of Representatives are all about. I remember when it was a more collegial place, when there was more give and take, when it was more bipartisan, and I want to see get back to that that time. What's happening now is, this is a place that is kind of closed off debate. Special interests are ruling the day. Members of both sides aren't able to read the legislation because we're not being given the information. Bills are being rewritten at the last minute in the Rules Committee. I heard Susan Milligan talk about the USA Patriot Act.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody thought that was going to be non-controversial when it came to the floor. John Conyers and Jim Sensenbrenner, two political opposites, agreed on it in the Judiciary Committee, which is one of the most polarizing committees in the Congress. Yet John Ashcroft didn't like it, and the leadership of the House didn't like it, and so the Rules Committee substituted, a different bill that nobody read that was, more oppressive in terms of cracking down on civil liberties, and it was brought to the floor immediately. That's not democracy. That's not what this place is supposed to be about, and people need to be more outraged about that.
Congressman McGovern, we've got the picture, and we thank you for chipping in on it. Thanks so much for joining us tonight with that. James McGovern, Congressman from the 3rd District of Massachusetts. I want to get a quick call before the break. Ryan's calling from Boston. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
How's it going?
Good.
When I first called in, I actually had a couple points to make, and I think I've picked up a third now. But one thing I wanted to just ask is how lobbying ever became constitutional. When you consider all the bribes, donations, the trips they're sending Congress people.
Freedom of speech, my friend. Freedom of speech.
Yeah, it's not freedom of speech when you're throwing money around, though. And the other thing is, the whole intention of Congress and the House is that you're supposed to be representing the district that elected you, whereas these lobbyists they're not coming from your own district. Not every district has their own set of lobbyists. It seems that if anybody should have the congressman's ear, it should be the people from their own district, and they should be representing their desires, their interests, their needs.
You sure like to think so. Ryan, I'm going to have to leave it there. We're coming up on a break, but we'll pick that up. Chris Rowland, just quickly, on your Medicare bill, lots of big money rolling around there as that went through.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when Congress passed that, they thought it was going to cost around $400 billion, which was expensive enough, but little did they know it actually is $534 billion. And perhaps even growing.
And those extra billions go into corporate pockets that are happy to shell out on the other end for lobbying. We are looking tonight at how the GOP-dominated Congress does business in 2004. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think business lobbyists got for the $800 million they spent on energy and Medicare bills? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how the GOP-dominated Congress does business in 2004. I have two guests from the Boston Globe, Susan Milligan and Christopher Rowland. They're three-part series really laid out a picture of what's going on in the Congress today, and a lot of it looked disturbing. But what do you think? Is this just minority party sour grapes, or do we have a problem here, a new problem here? And is congressional debate being stifled, congressional power being abused now more than ever? And why would that be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. They've laid out a whole picture here about legislation being rewritten in committee and then members of Congress being forbidden from changing any of that on the floor. Lawmakers kept in the dark until the very last minute about legislation they're going to have to vote on. More than 3,000 pork barrel projects never debated or voted on before they get into the final huge bill, and it's not even clear who the congressional patrons of those pork barrel projects are. Bills crafted behind closed doors. Few minority party members even given a chance to see what's going on. The amount of time spent on debating bills dropped dramatically. And behind all this, a select group of industry lobbyists with personal close ties and a lot of money flowing to decision makers in the majority party in Congress. What a picture. Dan's calling from Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
How are you tonight?
Just great, Dan.
Well, I think this may sound way to the left, but I think the Republican Party would really like to shut down the news networks, and they tried that with Nixon, with a guy named Clay Whitehead. They're going all over with the Rather thing. They're jumping all over it. I've never seen such defamation of character since the McCarthy years. I think they'd be very happy with a one-party system.
So you're not a GOP guy, that's clear, but have you seen evidence of this?
Look at Fox News Network. I have never seen a news media that where it's clear, for instance, in the Kerry, the Swift boat ads, where it's clear that Kerry is really talking on behalf of people he had just heard at the Winter Soldier meeting in Detroit. This is back in 71, I believe, before the Fulbright Committee. And I haven't seen one journalist go up against that in a hard way. I mean, Chris Matthews on Hardball, welcome back, this O'Neill guy, like a long-lost brother just a few days ago.
So you're saying news media stand up and pay attention to this stuff. And
I'm saying they are controlling the news media. They really wanted to jump all over the Rather thing and shut it down. They've had a tendency, and as you recall back in the Watergate days.
Yeah, we're not going back to the Watergate days tonight, Dan, but I appreciate your call. We really want to look at what's going on in Congress. We've got a couple of journalists here who are paying attention to what's going on there. Not everybody agrees with them, as we heard from David Dreyer. Let's get another view on the opposing front from Michael Frank. He joins us from Washington. He's vice president for government relations at the Heritage Foundation. He oversees Heritage's outreach to the House and Senate. He served as director of communications for House Majority Leader Dick Armey of Texas, a several-time guest on this show. Michael Frank, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening. How are you doing?
We're great. So you have watched what goes on in the House of Representatives for a long time, and we're reading an expose here that says majority control has come to mean something quite new, quite different, and much more controlling than it's ever been before, that debate's being shut down, that it's all middle-of-the-night skullduggery. It sounds like a mess down there. Do you buy the picture, Michael Frank?
Well, I read Susan Milligan's piece, the October 3rd version. I thought it was very good. And it just reminds me of a book the Heritage Foundation published 12, 13 years ago called The Ruling Class. Eric Felton wrote it, and it's the same thing. It starts out remarkably with a long discussion of, I guess it was a big highway bill of that year.
When the Democrats ruled the roost.
Right, and they controlled it, and we quoted at length, or the author quoted at length, a very young Chris Cox, a freshman member. He was then on the Transportation Committee. He was eminently frustrated because he couldn't get language for the bill. Even as the debate unfolded, there was still no language available for members, even of the committee, to read. And he was decrying this, and the entire book is one long sort of recitation of this, of the exact same sort of thing.
So we get that it's not a new problem, but do you see a new degree of pervasiveness of this kind of majority rule domination or not?
Well, I think what's new about it is that since the Republicans took over, they did have this sort of brief window of a few years where they were very self-conscious about trying to bring as many rules as possible to the floor with open rules and more open procedures. And they tried to do things to create more transparency. And that curtain started to drop a few years ago.
Why?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think part of it might have to do with it's a very narrow majority, and they feel there's no wiggle room for you know, anyone voting the wrong way, so to speak, and they've closed things down quite a bit. And the dysfunctionality over in the Senate may have something to do with it, but I'm not making excuses. I just think that there was a 3 or 4 year period that was different from both before and after in terms of the openness and the attempt to be open. And would it be a better thing if there was more chance for members and the public and experts to read legislation before it goes to the floor? You know, of course it would be better. The Medicare bill is a case in point, and that whole process is you know, is still with us, seared in our memories. That long 3 hour vote and the way in which it unfolded, and the fact that most members really did not know what it was they were voting on. They were working off of assurances from people they trusted.
It's kind of astonishing on a bill that big. Susan Milligan, come in here. Michael Frank is saying, look, people have always complained when they weren't in the ruling party, but even he's saying that transparency has diminished in the last few years here.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do you mean, even he?
Well, he's with the Heritage Foundation. He's Dick Armey's guy.
No. Let me tell you something about the Heritage Foundation. They're not partisan at all. They're a self-described conservative organization, but I talk to their analysts there a great deal. And, in fact, it's interesting you bring up the Medicare bill, because I remember I was hearing from some people at Heritage that Tom DeLay's office was, you know, sort of froze out the Heritage Foundation from discussions when Heritage criticized the Medicare bill as being too costly. So, no, they're issues people. They're not party people at all. So it doesn't surprise me at all that Michael would say that. It is different. Now, look, nobody says that the Democrats didn't use their authority when they were in power, and the Democrats on the Rules Committee would be the first ones to admit that. I do think that Mr. Dreyer – well, first of all, I want to say one thing about Mr. Dreyer. When he talked about how the Republicans now give them a motion to recommit,
right,
that's relatively meaningless. That's just a party-line vote, and it's not a genuine opportunity to change a bill. That's just saying you can revisit the bill. That's actually meaningless. So I would take issue with him on that. But he did hit on something that I think is at the heart of why this is happening, which is that it's so closely divided. I mean, back in the days when, you know, the majority and the minority were pretty far apart in numbers, and they were both really comfortable in their roles, the majority felt comfortable kind of throwing a few bones to the minority. They didn't feel threatened. They didn't think, ugh, one more election and we could lose the majority. The minority didn't really have any, you know, kind of realistic sense that they might take back the majority. So it was actually easier for them to be more collegial. And then you can't discount just the residual resentment from impeachment. I mean, that's still there, and it's just gotten worse. So I think those are the two things that are happening. And plus, you know, single-party rule in Washington. That's a very unusual situation.
The White House and both houses of Congress. Susan, I want to get one more call in here. Jim's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I think that at the bottom of this, in my opinion, is just the issue of integrity. Not only does it address the congressmen and being frank and honest about their own dealings and positions, but they can also use that integrity, if they had it, to say no to lobbyists and be honest about supporting their constituents. So to me, I always say integrity is doing what's right when no one's looking, and I think that, you know, we're lacking integrity anymore in Congress in general.
Jim, let us pick up the theme. Chris Rowland, doing the right thing when nobody's looking. Well, nobody's looking at a lot of what's going on here, but in the Medicare bill, everybody here tonight, Michael Frank included, is saying, whoa, that was not a paragon of integrity the way that went by.
Well, what's also amazing about it is how expensive it was and how many people climbed aboard as that thing started going through. I mean, virtually every sector of the healthcare economy came away with something there. And, you know, a billion here, a billion there, tens of billions here, tens of billions there. And by the time you have this thing, it's enormously expensive. You know, it's over $500 billion. And frankly, the people who lose are the actual, to some extent, are the beneficiaries themselves. I mean, it's one of the consequences of this is that the Medicare benefit itself is not that great. It has big gaps built into it. So that's one reason why Bush and the Republicans are getting the political bounce out of this, and there's been a big backlash. But when you start going into the underbrush of this bill and you see how individual members rewarded themselves, rewarded their own districts And how much money was spread around among states. It's really quite amazing.
Michael Frank, how do you think this ever gets sorted out?
Well, it's I do think there's a new level of sophistication to the lobbying that goes on in Washington. And it's pernicious, and it finds its way into so many bills now, both appropriations bills and a lot of those big authorization bills like highway bills and energy bills and the Medicare bill, as was discussed. How do you turn that around? You have to find a way to get the perspective of ordinary people more involved in the decision-making process. Because right now, for example, a think tank can go in and brief a member on some new idea or some new model, say, for Medicare. They nod their heads. They think it's a good idea. Mm. They agree with you. But then outside their office is a long line of different special interest people from the healthcare sector saying, can you just tweak this reimbursement formula? Can you just give a helping hand to this rural hospital?
And they've got the hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying money, and off we go. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. But Michael Frank at the Heritage Foundation, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Christopher Rowland and Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe, thanks for some terrific, detailed, in-depth reporting here. It's quite a picture you've painted. We appreciate all the work you put into it. Susan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Chris, thanks for joining us right here.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, Howard Stern goes to satellite radio. This is On Point. Shock jock Howard Stern rocked the broadcasting world this week when he announced that he'll be taking his highly rated radio program off of the airwaves in 2006 and into the uncensored world of satellite radio.
I'm done with this kind of radio. It's over. It's over. I'm getting a divorce.
Satellite radio subscribers pay a monthly fee to receive commercial-free music, news, and sports programming through special receivers analogous to cable TV. Stern portrays his five-year, $500 million deal with Sirius Satellite Radio, one of two major players in the field, as his response to the FCC's crackdown on broadcast indecency.
It's happy for me because I've waited my whole life for something like this, where I can really get control and do what I want on the air.
The FCC has levied record fines against Stern, and earlier this year, Clear Channel dropped Stern's show from six markets under the threat of fines. Industry analysts say Howard Stern could provide the jump start that satellite radio has been looking for. Sirius and its main rival, XM Satellite Radio, have a total of 3.1 million subscribers. Stern's morning program draws more than 8.5 million listeners a week. Sirius has also recently added NFL football, while XM this week added former Morning Edition host Bob Edwards and shock jocks Opie and Anthony to its lineup. XM also carries this show, On Point. I'm joined now from Los Angeles by Sarah McBride, who covers radio and digital media for The Wall Street Journal. Sarah, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So how big an industry is waiting in the wings here? How important might Howard Stern's jump to satellite be for satellite radio?
Well, Sirius Satellite Radio thinks it's extremely important. Joe Clayton, the head of Sirius, told me today that their most important move up until snagging Howard Stern was getting the rights to broadcast exclusively on satellite NFL football games. And they've also got some other sports deals like that. His second one was Howard Stern, and he says that it's like having the two big pieces on the Monopoly board. It's like having a Boardwalk and I forget what the other one is, Mayfair.
But Park Place.
Yeah, Park Place. He said it was like having Boardwalk and Park Place.
So what is involved in going from regular broadcast radio to satellite?
Well, you mean for an average listener, it would involve, if you don't have a car which has it built in, you'd have to go to a store like Circuit City or Radio Shack and buy some hardware. I actually stopped in at a Radio Shack to see how complicated it would be to hook it up. It seems fairly simple. That would probably run about $100. And then you'd have to subscribe, and both services charge around $10 a month to subscribe to satellite radio.
And off they go, now hoping that Howard Stern, Raunchy Shock Jock, will bring millions of people to do just that. Susan McBride, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Susan McBride with the Wall Street Journal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.